Oh, it's festival time, and all kinds of great festivals happening in our region. And we're going to try to tell you about as many of them as we can over the next several days, weeks, months, But one of the ones coming up is the Old Tone Music Festival, which happens in Hillsdale, September 5th through the 8th at the Cool Whisper Farm. How neat is that? Cool Whisper Farm. And you can find out more by going to oldtone.org. And we're going to be playing some of the artists this morning going into our segments from who will be performing at the Old Tone Music Festival. And that was the Foghorn String Band. So this is your stuff, Jim. Well, I mean, not jazz, but it's all good music.
Yeah,
great local music, and it's good stuff. We welcome you to find out more. You can check out the playlist, wamc.org/roundtable. And, of course, we would love to hear from you at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the group to you this morning. We welcome the Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran Berman is here. Hello, Fran.
Good morning. Good morning.
Very nice to talk to you. We were lucky enough to have you in the building last week, but we're lucky to have you back, even by phone, today, and we're thrilled that you're with us, as always.
That was a lot of fun, and I will be back. I think you have to get the squad back, Joe.
All right. Well, that talk to your friend Teresa. She's good at wrangling all that. She's your agent.
Okay. Good to know.
Get her on it.
Okay.
Preceptor in public speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University. We have the two Harvard folks on with us this morning. Terry Gibson joins us. Hello, Terry. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me.
How are things?
Things are good. You know, weather's nice. Having a couple of weeks between us and the semester.
Terry, is Harvard back for the year, or are they waiting for a bit?
The fall term starts September 3rd, and we just finished summer school.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, so, same for you, Matt.
All right. And you were a little garbled there, Terry. So if we have problems with you, Michael, come on and try to reestablish a connection. But we'll so far, so good. We'll just keep an ear out for it.
Okay, let's see what we can do.
All right. Excellent. Let's see. We also have Jim Ketterer, Senior Fellow of Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Hello, Senior Fellow. How are you?
Senior Fellow. Well met.
Yes.
I'm doing well, and I haven't been on with Terry or Fran in a long time, so I'm really looking forward to it.
A good day to be on the show.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we got a lot to talk about. A lot of good stuff happening. Well, a lot of stuff happening this week. I don't know. Jury's out on whether it's good or bad, but we'll see.
Although I have to say, Joe, and I think I've mentioned this to you before off air, but I'll throw it out there now on air, that I wonder if, you know, once in a while, maybe like once a month, once every 6 months or something, we could do a show that is just focused on the good news of the day. I don't know if that's possible. We might have to wait until November. But just something that went right, people that we like.
Yeah.
Stuff to talk about that doesn't leave us thoroughly depressed.
Yeah, it sounds like a great idea. And
everybody always says that to me.
Maybe I've even tried it, but it's hard because then also people don't like, it's difficult for people to comment on things that they're not ticked off about. But it's a great idea. We would try it. If you know what, baby steps. We should at least have one or two stories at the end that are positive.
That's
we
a
can
way
sort
to
of
do
start
it.
There.
Yeah.
And but it's a great idea, and it's a good thing. Of course, I do remember we came close one day. We did a lot of positive stories, and somebody said, "Well, you know, we still have climate change. We still have war. We still have hunger. Like, stop being so damn happy."
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was
so
one time you asked the audience and then the panelists also, How would you spend your money if you won the Powerball?
Oh, that's
was,
right.
Was
I
that
love
some
that.
Very high number that, and it's always seems high, but it was especially high. And there were some very, very creative answers.
We have creative listeners.
Yeah.
And if you
and
would,
panelists.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's absolutely true. We have also joining us, she's running a little bit late, but she will be here soon, and that is Libby Post, political consultant and lobbyist. And we will welcome Libby to the conversation as soon as she arrives. In the meantime, we'll get to the topics at hand, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. The Democratic National Convention is happening. It is about to take place in the city of Chicago. And of course, a lot of people very early on making connections to the 1968 convention, which probably at this point now may be a little unfair, but we'll see how this goes. Vice President Kamala Harris is taking parts of Biden's agenda, betting that a younger generation will appeal to many of these. The platform is out now. I want to say coronation, and that's pretty much what it is. I mean, she's already been, right? She already has the votes, is the candidate. So this is a party over the next 4 days in the city of Chicago. And the president of the United States will be leading things off tonight, speaking on Monday night and setting it off. And then other huge names in the Democratic Party will be speaking throughout the week, highlighting, bringing us up to Thursday night, where Kamala Harris will speak before the group. So the big question is, how will it go? And we're going to get, just so you know, we're going to get into some of the, we'll talk about sort of generalities of the convention itself. Then I want to bring in this idea of the Gaza protests that were talked about, maybe thought it wasn't a great idea, and then they are now going through with these protests. So we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But I just want to separate the two for a moment and talk about the fact that the Democrats will be meeting and trying to present a unified front as their convention kicks off. How successful do you think they will be in with that chore, Terry Gibson?
Well, I think it's kind of hard to separate what happens at the convention versus what's happening outside the convention, because I think what happens at the convention is very contingent on how things happen in the world. You know, you'll have the protests, you'll have the Republicans and Donald Trump out there. There will be a lot of entities and individuals that are out there trying to pull attention away from the convention, while obviously the Democrats are trying to rally everyone to pay attention to the convention. I think as it stands right now, the way that the convention has been scripted out, the speakers that are planned to speak, I think it stands to be very successful. I know I'm excited about it. I think it's an exciting lineup. There's a lot of different speakers that will appeal to lots of different audiences from all ages across the country, and I think even globally. So I think they've done a very good job of reaching out to everyone, and I'm looking forward to it. But there are so many potential types of disruptions that could happen that I know that they must be on the lookout for that, and hopefully they have a contingency plan for if some of those things happen.
Well, we hope and we assume, right? And that's always, I think, with any of these events, that's what you ultimately hope for. Jim Ketterer.
So many people have been talking about this whole year, not just this convention, but this whole year being some kind of weird replay of 1968, or if not an exact replay, something that seems to mirror it in some ways. And I certainly hope that the convention of 2024 in Chicago is going to be a lot more effective politically and a lot more peaceful for the participants and for the residents of Chicago than 1968 was. So, but it does, as we're going to talk about in more detail, does have some of the kinds of things that are possibly concerning in terms of disruptions, in terms of protests, in terms of, as Terry was saying, what's going on outside the convention versus what's going on inside the convention. I do have one just question about Chicago and something that the governor of Illinois said before people were arriving. He was urging people to sample all the charms of the city, and he said, but be careful if you have this drink. It's either called Malort or Malort. I've never had it, but I looked it up, and it was described as having the taste of burnt tires with a strong flavor of bug spray. So if there's anybody out there in the listening audience who could educate me about what this stuff is, why anybody would drink it, and what the governor is talking about, I'm all ears.
It seems like an odd thing to bring up in a welcome to Chicago message, isn't it? Who knows? Was it a joke?
Or I think it was a joke, but it's apparently it's a real thing.
It's anise and wormwood was introduced in Chicago in the 1930s. Wong produced by the Carl Jepsen Company. 35% alcohol, has been around since 1933 at 70 proof. And apparently this is a full-bodied of unusual botanicals. It has a bitter taste savored by two-fisted drinkers, Jim. So that's probably why you are unaware of it. Being a one-fister,
you know, as right. You know that every millennial and Gen Z attendee to the convention will now go out and get this stuff.
Well, I know. It's like they're on the payroll, right, to help sell it. It is now, and just so you all know, it is now available in the convenient mini six-pack. So
all right,
want you to be aware of that. Jepsen's Malort. It's M-A-L-O with the two little O's over it.
The umlaut.
Malort, then.
Yeah.
A Chicago icon is what it says. So we'll find out.
I always say
we learn something new every day on the
that
show.
That toddle in town.
We'll be toddling right into right back to the Hyatt Regency, a little tipsy, but that's all right. Libby Post.
Hi,
how are you? Good to have you here. Do you want me to go to Fran first, or do you want to take over?
Oh, well, you know, I just hope none of the influencers decide to have this drink before
under
they
the
go
influence.
On.
Yes.
So that they're not under the influence.
Yes. The influenced influencers.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm hoping that the protesters understand what is at stake. And that they keep it peaceful. I think everybody has the right to protest. I think the way the city has set things up, it's not going to be like 1968 when they're right out front. They're not far away, but they're away, and there are security zones and all that sort of stuff set up. And as Pritzker said the other night, I think he might have said it yesterday, I saw it on the news, if you're going to do anything illegal, you're going to get arrested. And people need to understand that law enforcement is there to keep everyone safe. What we need to watch out for, I'm sure, are the infiltrators from the GOP. I'm sure there will be some of them in the rallies, in the demonstrations, trying to gin everybody up and to make it so that there would be violence. And I think that hopefully the organizers of the various protest groups understand that and don't fall prey to it, although some people can just get caught up in the moment. But we don't need a repeat of 68. I don't think it's going to be that bad, but we need to come out of the convention fully united. And my question has been, where were they in Milwaukee? Why didn't they go and protest the GOP convention? Why is it only that the Democrats? You don't want the other people to listen to you either? So.
I just received word, and I apologize for this, but Phil Donahue passed away.
Oh.
Just announced that Phil Donahue passed away,
wow.
88 years old, and was a mentor to me. We are, although we share a last name, we are no relation whatsoever. Although I will tell you that on more than a few occasions, people would say, oh, are you Phil Donahue? Are you related to Phil Donahue? And if it helped you get, you know, a better table.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right, right.
And I did an interview with him a few years back, and honoring him in a documentary about him, and hopefully we'll get to play that over sometime over the next a little bit. But this was a guy who came out of Dayton, Ohio, and revolutionized television. And I would say at the time for the better, because people did not have access to be able to talk on television, to ask questions to people like Margaret Mead or like Ayn Rand or Phyllis Schlafly. And so they didn't have that opportunity. And Phil Donahue gave them that opportunity. The show became very popular, moved to the city of Chicago, Illinois, and stayed there for a very long time until finally it became so popular. They moved it to New York City, and he broadcast out of 30 Rock at NBC, even though the show was syndicated. And he would bring the show all over. I remember growing up seeing him in Philadelphia and in Baltimore and in Chicago, and it was always just a terrific scene. Being with Mr. Donahue, I have to check the dates. I want to say it was 2021. I think it was the last interview I did with him. I did it with both Phil and Marlo together, it was very special and very fun. So I just want to say that we certainly are very saddened. I'm very saddened to hear about the passing of Phil Donahue. I think he was a true broadcasting legend. Funny enough, I was just watching. I went down to Philadelphia on Friday. It was off Friday. I went down on Friday, and I sat on the train and I watched an old Phil Donahue show where he was interviewing Bob Newhart and Don Rickles together.
Oh, that must have been fun.
Oh, it was great. Wow. It was just fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. And Rickles wasn't even like being Rickles. And I don't think Phil Donahue knew what to do with that exactly. Like, he was a nice Don Rickles. It was very funny. But anyway, we'll work more on that. But in the meantime, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from Fran, and we'll continue with our topics after this.
Heartache, oh heartache, take on the form of a pain.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Remember, we were doing an event with Phil Donahue one time, and he would start every event when I would say, okay, you ready? And he goes, all right, I'm ready if you're ready, and I'll behave if you behave. And I said, well, that doesn't seem like much fun. He goes, all right, then let's not behave. All right, let's go to Fran Berman with her thoughts on the Democratic National Convention happening tonight. This afternoon, I guess, is the official gaveling in. And in Chicago, Illinois. Fran.
Well, first of all, I'm really sorry that he passed, and he was special to you.
Yes.
I think he was pre-Oprah, right, Joe?
Oh, he was pre-Oprah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the Oprah phenomena was ultimately what led the show off the air after, you know, 35 years or whatever it was. But, you know, things change and things move on. And they were both very complimentary of each other. And we were just talking in the studio. That was a lot different than Oprah was very much in the Phil Donahue model, less so than the Geraldos and Sally, Jesse, Raphael, and Ricky Lake and Jenny Jones and
Jerry Springer.
And Jerry
yeah,
Springer
yeah,
and
those
that,
guys
and that
were
top.
A whole
so,
different ballgame.
You know, and to my knowledge, even though he did wear a dress in one episode, I don't believe he ever brought up a paternity suit.
No.
So there is that.
Joe said he was a very modern guy. My friend, Anne Egonet, who's an art historian at Barnard, says one of the big trends in fashion is the whole blurring of conventional gender stereotypes. So he was a guy before his time.
Yes. Agreed.
Okay. Back to the DimFest. let's see. You know, I just wanted to say I think the next bunch of days and into next week will be full of minute discussions of various details about what worked, what didn't work, who was happy, who was unhappy about the convention. But to me, still, there's just nothing usual about this election. It really, for me, is not a difference between two candidates, you know, either of who would generally play by the presidential rules and promote their own personal philosophies about government and democracy. To me, it's really a choice between someone who we have some real experience with, who wants to take democracy down and, you know, increasingly is figuring out how he might do that, and another alternative, which, you know, gives many of us hope. And so, you know, in some sense, no matter what happens in the DimFest, and they have a great lineup, I'd love to see Taylor Swift and Beyonce there, just saying.
You never know.
Yeah, you never know. It's not 1968. We didn't have this kind of radical choice, in my opinion, in 1968. We may have protests. I don't know how they're going to go. I hope that they are peaceful. But, yeah, I mean, I just think that it's just my opinion, listeners. You know, Trump is the most dangerous thing that has happened to the U.S. in my memory. And so I hope the DimFest goes well. I hope Kamala gets, you know, a big push from it. But for me, how it goes, you know, in some senses in the noise, and sadly. And I'm hoping it all goes well, but I'm nervous. Of course, I sent an email to Joe yesterday, and I was saying, the news story I really want to talk about, and I'm curious about how this works out for the Dems, is that Grindr crashed in Milwaukee during the Republican convention.
Gee, I wonder why.
Yeah, so my question is Grindr going to crash this week in Chicago? You know, that's what I'm going to pay attention to, sadly.
Probably not.
Well, for the sake of Grindr, we hope, yeah.
Well, it's really about who's in the closet and who's not.
Yeah, I mean, it's really like, does anyone care? But I do think that the Republicans actually have a stand on these kinds of issues, and it's interesting to contrast that with Grindr crashing. There is, and I checked it out on Snopes, so I did fact check this, and it is not true. But there's a very amusing thing that Santos also said, that this was the Super Bowl of Grindr.
Oh,
so,
God, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and this is, and just for those who may not know, Grindr is a Tinder, an LGBTQIA hookup. Tinder hookup
site. It's a gay hookup way.
Right, right. And so it's so busy during the GOP convention because there are so many closet cases that go to this convention, and this happens all the time. I mean, we've seen these numbers spike every time they get together.
Well, it used to be.
And it's astounding because they then pass their platform, you know, criminalizing our behavior.
What I find interesting is, because it used to be in the old days, by the way, Fran said, I'm not going to talk about this. But anyway.
Yeah. No, I did. I lied.
Yeah. It's okay.
That was a switcheroo, Fran.
My imperfection.
Fran wrote me an email. I want to talk about this, but I won't. Oh, by the way. Anyway. But it used to be the old stories about, 10, 15, 20 years ago, it was always about
prostitution.
Yeah. You know, the prostitution and the, right. And the, how they would.
Straight men.
Yeah. There you go. Okay. So we have we've figured that out. And now we'll go to
good reasons to listen to Roundtable.
Yeah, right. Now we'll go to some letters. Anything you want to add, Terry? Not about Grindr, but just in general.
I think I'll stay away from this topic and just wait till we move on to something else.
Okay, great. We'll we'll go. We'll go to Barbara, who said, should Kamala go out at any point and address the protesters? I don't know. Mm-hmm. No, right? I mean, there was a we'll get into this when we come back from our break. But the articles that have been circulating here over the last day or two have been that there was a real thought process that we don't want to screw up the convention. We want it to be united, and we're not going to protest. And then after, and at least this is claimed to be the reason. I don't know whether this really is the reason, but the reason that when Kamala basically told protesters to shh, I'm talking. They got irked by that and then said, okay, we're going to go off and do what we're going to do. And I will say that my understanding is that most of the protests are expected to take place on the front end of mm-hmm. the convention.
Right.
And then start to dissipate as the event unfolds.
But let's not underestimate the impact of Hamas knowing that the convention is about to start. Saying, oh, no, we didn't agree to this agreement, not also having an impact on the demonstration. So,
John writes.
I just wanted to follow up because I do think that's an interesting question about whether she should directly address the protesters. And I think the way that she's been addressing them as part of her talking points in her actual speeches has been very effective, and I think she should continue to do that. I do not think it would be strategically wise for her to go out to the protest site and try to speak directly to them because she doesn't really have anything to share with them beyond what she's already shared. She's not the president. She has limited control over policy decisions at this moment, and I think that would only end up being a real disappointment both for her and the protesters, frankly. And the press would jump all over it, and they mm-hmm. would frame the message in a way that would be very negatively reflective on the Harris campaign. So I think she should stay away from the protest site.
And unlike in 68, when the Vietnam War did have an impact on the election and on the Democratic Party, this conflict, from polling results, are showing that this conflict is not rising up to a level of importance for the vast majority of voters and even younger voters. So it's a totally different dynamic.
I also think that the protesters' big argument is with Biden. And since Biden is going to be there tonight, Joe, you said the protests are likely to be stronger at the beginning of the convention, and that might be why. Protests, the policies that they don't like that are being carried out by the person who is currently president and controls those policies. And that might be a way for them to have their say, for it to align with the person who they have a gripe with, and then move on to the rest of the convention.
And with that said, I mean, it's you were talking about the press coverage. I mean, these events are pretty tightly choreographed, mm-hmm. and the networks are along for the cable networks are along for the ride, and they certainly did that with the Republican National Convention. I assume,
but if she doesn't go, which it seems like that's not the right play, and right now we're talking plays. Is there anyone who could go and represent her and kind of pursue this more centrist approach that she seems to be taking?
I don't think going to talk to them in this setting is going to accomplish anything. It'll just end up being a screaming match. So it's not worth it.
Are there leaders?
Go ahead, Terry.
Well, I was just going to say, according to various reports I've read, that members of her campaign, high-level members of her campaign, have met offline in private with various leaders of various protest groups trying to reach some kind of agreement. So I think those conversations are definitely going on in the background. They're just not being publicized. And they're in controlled environments, which is where they should be. You know, going into a protest site is a completely uncontrolled environment. It would be just a strategically huge risk, and it's unnecessary at this particular time. There might come a time when it would be necessary, but I don't think we're anywhere near this candidate having to take that kind of risk, or anyone in her administration being asked to kind of do that in public in an uncontrolled situation. Is just ripe for all kinds of mistakes.
Also, given what we've been through in the past month or so, I think the Secret Service would definitely
be against that.
Yeah, they've got a lot going on. A lot of reporting of just of what it's been like in covering these last 4 weeks post an assassination attempt. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will return. We welcome your letters. We also will continue our conversation on this topic about the convention and other stuff. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
One more time with Bill and darling, take it from the top.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Just a reminder, we're playing some of the artists who will be at the Old Tone Music Festival in Hillsdale on September 5th through the 8th at Cool Whisper Farm. OldTone.org for more information. Find out more at our playlist, WAMC.org/Roundtable for more information. All right, let's go to a couple of letters. Kathleen says, best thing that could happen, Kamala gives a fiery, uplifting speech about uplifting the middle class. And then Dolly Parton comes out and sings 9 to 5, and Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin join her on stage for a bow. That's very specific.
Yeah, well, I like it, though.
It's very choreographed and very specific. And yes to Beyonce and Taylor Swift, but Dolly would unite the country, and she would make my 82-year-old mom, who always votes, so, so happy. All right, Kathleen's got her idea of what she's expecting.
I think it's a great idea.
Everybody loves Dolly Parton.
Yeah, yeah, right. And she's been a great foil for J.D. Vance, so it's been wonderful.
She's also an extraordinary leader and a businesswoman. I mean, let me just point that out.
Yeah,
it's like everybody thinks about Dolly as a national treasure, which she is, by the way. But she's a great business person.
Yes, she is.
She's an incredibly creative songwriter, and, she deserves every positive thing she gets.
And philanthropist as well.
Right, and she has put books in the hands of young people across the country. She's got a whole
project.
Program,
yeah, and it's and millions of books that have gone out.
Right.
It's very impressive. All right, we go to this note from John on convention speakers. Kathy Hochul? Really? Electrifying, says John. It seems that no one in New York wants to hear her speak, so I guess Chicago is safe. And is it just me, or have we seen enough of Bill Clinton? If the theme is the moving of the party into the future, can we stop hearing from the past? Be well, all, says John.
I don't mind
hearing
Kathy.
Yeah, but we got influencers. We got the old guys. We got the new guys. I mean, isn't this just, these conventions are performance art, and they go according to a template, and, it's the template.
And New York is really pivotal to taking back the House. So, sure, they're going to have the governor come and speak. Why not? And it's another woman in power.
And I don't know if people can prove me wrong on this, but I think it is not unlikely to have the governor of the Democratic or Republican governor, depending on which convention you're talking about, speak at the national convention.
Well, but that's Pritzker, and he is going to speak because it's in Illinois.
Yeah.
No, but I'm just saying that New York, given its cachet,
it's a big,
no matter
state.
Where you are in the country, you know, you look at Cuomo in '84. I mean, you tend to invite the Democrat, and I'm not. Please don't write me letters
Newsom
about.
But Newsom isn't speaking, right?
Is Newsom speaking?
I don't know.
I didn't see his name anywhere.
I thought that.
Well, I will look that up.
But I don't know what the problem is with Bill Clinton speaking. I mean, a former president, aside from whatever one might think of his personal problems, this is, you know, one of the most successful, adept politicians of the last several decades. And, you know, this is a convention that brings together the Democrats who have served before and who we want to serve in the future. That doesn't seem like a programming error to me.
And Jimmy Carter's grandson, I think, is going to be
speaking
too.
That.
So all the many of the remaining alive Democratic presidents.
I will speak up in
Carter
defense of the
said
letter
he
writer.
Wanted to like. Oh, I. This is so heartbreaking. Carter said he wanted to stay alive.
Right. To see her.
Vote for Kamala.
That is like, so cool, and I like. If,
it's so cool and heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking, but I mean, my goodness, the man has outlived every expectation. So to make it that much further, God bless him, and hopefully it'll happen. But also, just to still be, you know, like thoughtful, active. You know, that's great stuff. Terry, you want to defend the letter writer?
I think it's a good point. When exactly are we finally going to allow the next generation of leaders to come up and really take the focus, take a spotlight? It seems like that is finally happening. It's happening primarily because Joe Biden has finally decided to step down. But is it happening fast enough? Is this a missed opportunity by the convention planners to really bring some of those new leaders forward and put more spotlight on them? Is it really to our benefit to give Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, I think they're both speaking, as much airtime as we are? I understand the dilemma. You also have Barack Obama speaking. We're fortunate to have all of these past presidents still alive. So if you let one speak, it's hard not to let the other one speak. I understand why they have to do it. But, you know, Bill Clinton did leave office as a very popular president, but he made a lot of mistakes and did a lot of damage to the Democratic Party, his reputation, at least temporarily, and we have recovered from that. So I just don't know how much longer it's necessary to bring him out to be a spokesperson for a generation that wasn't even alive when he was president. So I do think there's a good point there. I understand why the decisions are being made, but at some point – we are going to have to turn over the microphone and the primetime speaking slots to people that are under the age of 60.
Terry makes a good point about the next generation and maybe even the generation that's before Kamala Harris's generation. Let's remember, it was 2004 when Barack Obama spoke and really brought down the House. And at the time, he was an Illinois state senator. And so he was not well known on the national stage. And this was one of those important jumping off points for his campaign that was going to be coming and the next generation coming along.
And let's not forget that, okay, here are the Democrats highlighting former presidents who are still standing with the party. And Bush didn't go to the GOP convention. Paul Ryan didn't go. Mitt Romney didn't go to the GOP convention. And I think as a juxtaposition between the two, this shows we still, the Democrats still have this bench of support from former presidents and former leaders compared to the GOP, which has become a cult.
I just want to, we only have about 2 or 3 minutes before we have to go, but there's a lot in many of the articles that I've been reading over the last several days have used the term of the passing of the torch. And I understand that with Biden getting out and handing over the reins of the campaign to Kamala Harris and the delegates going with that. bringing in younger voices. I understand all of that, but you do have to honor your history too, right? I mean, there, mm-hmm. it doesn't seem like it has to be one or another. It can be both.
And she's hauling out all kinds of people. I mean, Shapiro has been on the trail. Whitmer has been mm-hmm. on the trail. Buttigieg has been on the trail. Newsom is out there. I have a question for you guys. Where's Stacey Abrams? Is she? She seems to be missing in action, but maybe I'm reading the wrong stuff.
I think you're right, and I think that is a strategic mistake. I mean, I thought Biden should have appointed Stacey Abrams chair of the party and not Jamie Harrison. I think the party would have been in a much better organizing position if that had happened.
Interesting.
Yeah, I wonder about that myself. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Harris campaign reaches out to her at some point, or the Harris administration hopefully mm-hmm. reaches out to her at some point and offers her a position. I want to talk a little bit more about Bill Clinton, though, because Bill Clinton, very much like Joe Biden, is not the speaker that he used to be. I mean, Bill Clinton used to be a phenomenal speaker, but he's not that anymore. I've seen him speak a few times in the last couple of years, and you know, he struggles with language, and it's just the energy, the passion is not quite what it used to be. And I do think that it is incredibly important that the spotlight, the primetime speaking spots, really be used to galvanize that base of voters that is either still on the fence, still maybe undecided, younger generation of Democrats that want to get involved. And I do share the letter writer's concerns that these older faces may not be the messenger to best do it. Hopefully, this counter programming with the younger influencers will be close enough to those speaking slots that they'll work out in balance in an effective way. But I do have some concerns about it.
I don't know. I disagree with that a little bit. I think you kind of have to have Clinton. He was president. You know, he's a big part of the Democratic Party. You can't have only him, and you can't give him all the time. But I think not having him is a much bigger deal than having him. And if nobody wants to listen to him, you go out and get a snack while he's talking. I mean, you know, that's okay.
We always need snack time.
Or a Maylort.
Yes, or a Maylort. That's right. Very nice. Ray, have you ever had Maylort? No. Ray says no. Never had that. But were you aware of it before Jim brought it up? No. Also no. All right.
Get going, Ray.
No,
Joe, we want a report.
You're going to use this now for advertising for this. And you are going to be the guy that got a million people hooked on
this is not, 70%. This is not an endorsement. We're just trying to figure things out. That's all. That's all. It's only an investigative. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We're going to talk about those influencers. We'll cue Fran up. She can discuss why this is so important and so different, and we'll do much more than that after this quick break.
Get you. We're not as tired as we would like to think, I bet you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion talking about the Democratic National Convention, which begins tonight in Chicago, starts this afternoon, but coverage will begin tonight, and we'll have coverage right here on NPR. Also, we'll have it over the next several nights, Monday through Thursday, and all kinds of things going on. We've been discussing that over the first hour of our program. I just want to mention that I had said earlier this hour that Phil Donahue had passed away, the talk show great. Phil Donahue passed away at the age of 88. It was announced this morning. We're going to remember him in our 11 o'clock hour and play part of an interview that we did with him in 2017, which is just one of my favorite interviews of all time. Such a great guy. I just want to tell a really quick story. My father's name was Phil Donahue.
Ah.
So the the fun that would ensue when my dad would show up to like stay at a Holiday Inn in Wheeling, West Virginia, and they saw on the docket that Phil Donahue was coming in, and they put his name in lights, welcome Phil Donahue, and then my dad would walk in and they would just be crushed, you know. And and he would turn to one of his colleagues and say, "Does this look like Marlo Thomas to you?" So that was a constant thing. So my mom, both my mom and dad are gone, but my mom was always a fan, and she became a real fan when my mother was very outspoken about the Gulf War. Following 9/11 and the war in Iraq, and was always protesting and very involved in that. Phil Donahue did a film, a documentary called Body of War, and that film was shown at the Woodstock Film Festival, and Phil Donahue was speaking, and we were invited. Meyer Blaustein, who runs the festival, invited Mom and I to go down and to meet Phil and to see the film.
Aww.
And so we went down, and my mother just like he was so sweet to her, she was so sweet to him, and it was just beautiful. It was lovely, lovely. So I have this gorgeous picture of my mother who's just beaming. And Phil Donahue, and I have it on my desk. So I don't know. A couple of weeks later, I was mentioning on the air, and I said I have this great picture of Phil Donahue and my mom, and I said I think I just want to put it in my wallet, and that way I can just show everyone that these are my parents. Okay, I thought it was funny.
Yeah, your dad not so much.
My mom calls me up about an hour after the show and says, your father is crushed. You have to call dad and apologize. And okay. I said, oh my God. I said, well, he can take a joke. And she goes, no, he can't. Which he could, but in this case, hit a little
some
too
jokes.
Close to home. No,
yeah.
That's right. I told this story the other day too, but I think this, this was a guy who once on his 60th wedding anniversary, my mother said, I don't want to party. I don't want to do anything. I just want to go out and have a lobster dinner. And my father said, why should we kill a lobster for something that happened 60 years ago? So that was my dad.
My God.
So I didn't think that would upset him.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, so we'll remember Phil Donahue later on in the roundtable program. All right, let's get back to work here and talk about what is going on.
Joe.
Yes.
So all of my fantasy parents and actual parents are gone, so I can say this just to you and like a billion other people out there. But my fantasy parents were Mr. Rogers and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. A couple you couldn't even imagine. But wouldn't they have been great parents?
Oh, they would have been great. Oh, yeah, they would have been fantastic parents. Yeah, a lot.
Yeah.
Very good. And they probably would have been quite compatible, too. Very, very nice people. Lovely, lovely, thoughtful people. All right, Fran, let me put you on the spot. There's a big story about how influencers, social media influencers, are a big part of this convention, and they're being invited on purpose, and they want them to be at the table, they want them to be there, they want them to talk about what's happening, and so why is this something? Well, two questions. One, why is this important? And two, is it important? And two, why is this something that the Democrats would obviously try to do and the Republicans have not?
It's a good question. And I'll give you a Zen answer, which is it's both not important and pretty important. So I don't know. Whoever you pick, there's some political calculus as to, you know, how to make this the best performance art you probably can, and they pick influencers. In particular, they have picked at least five influencers, and their names are, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing everything correctly, Deja Fox, Nabella Noor, Carlos Eduardo Espina, Olivia Juliana, and John Russell. All of these folks are Gen Z and millennial influencers, and together they have well over 24 million social media followers. Mm-hmm. And So, you know, why them? And there's lots of other influencers. And why anybody? Why the Clintons? And so, you know, someone else can figure that one out. But why is this important? And, you know, to me, this shows the rise of social media as a mainstream information source and a mainstream, really critical communications infrastructure that is being brought to play, not just in the election, but information about all kinds of things. If you think about it, social media is the place where people make announcements, where you get fired, where you quit your job, where you get hired for a job, where you come out, where you, you know, announce your wedding, where you do any number of things. And so in some sense, if you think about this as a really, the acknowledgement of a really important communication mechanism for our time, this says that people who are popular in social media are now really mainstream people, important enough to try to win over voters. Now, that's both exciting and a little concerning, not because of these individuals particularly. And if you think about it, their topics they're going to talk about are things that play very well to the Democrats: climate change, abortion, labor unions, working class. One of them is Latino. One of them is Muslim. You know, they're going to talk about their hope for the future, et cetera. So all of that is kind of what you would expect. But the social media part, I think, is important. If you think about social media as critical communications infrastructure, and it is, Pew did a study that said around 50% of America get their news, their mainstream news, from social media. About a third of those guys under 30 get all their news from TikTok. And so if you think about it, you know, is this a good source of news? And as we talked about before in the roundtable, social media has the following problem. Is it like a telephone line where it's just a conduit? You can say anything you want over the telephone, and the telephone company isn't telling you what you can talk about. Or is it a publisher? Is it like a newspaper where the content that you hear is curated? So if there's hate speech or things that are patently untrue, they're less likely to, not all periodicals, just we know, Breitbart News, for example, they're not as likely to land in a published venue. Social media is somehow in between. And we've really struggled, not just in the U.S., but even in the EU, that has really pretty progressive laws about digital media. Everybody sort of struggled with how you curate hate speech, how you curate misinformation, how you curate exploitation, et cetera. So that's going on in the background. However, the Democrats are using this big time because they realize that a lot of the people they want to reach are following these influencers. They've invited over 200 of them. They have a place where they can do podcasts and talk about things. And by the way, social media is also giving Trump trouble right now. I saw an article in the paper that said right-wing influencers are mad at Trump.
Yeah.
Because they think he's a little bit too soft now. He's trying to, you know, get more votes and sort of back away from issues of race and things that they care about, immigration. And they don't like that. They want him to be more hardcore, and they're sort of threatening to abandon him in some way.
Good.
So social media, so that to me, that's the big news. Social media, if we didn't already know it, is a big, big deal, so much so that it's now becoming a mainstream part of communication strategy. These influencers, I would love to hear what our listeners think of them. I don't know them.
Well, they're very nice, and they'll introduce themselves. But I do think it's an eclectic bunch, right? I mean, I think when you say influencers, that can be a billion things. I mean, if you spend any time on Instagram or TikTok or Snapchat or any of the platforms, you know how influencers, you get an idea of influencers, but man, they're all over the place. And
well,
so
I think that,
yeah, go ahead, Terry.
I think one way to think about them is maybe the way that our generation used to think about people like Walter Cronkite. They really are the new media source. They're the new source for news. They're the trusted voice that millions and millions and millions of Americans and really just citizens of the globe look to find out what's going on in the world and to hear it framed in a way that they can relate to and understand. And the students that I'm teaching every day in the classroom now, they don't separate media from social media. It's just all media. This is where they go to get informed about everything. They do not watch traditional television in the way that many of us grew up doing. They go to these various influencer sites. And I don't think they really think about them as influencers either. These are just people that they follow. The thing I'm interested in with this convention is how the legacy media is going to cover these influencers, or if they're going to cover them at all, because these influencers are really taking business away in significant numbers from the legacy media. And one of the concerns that I see that is happening is that more and more and more legacy media is behaving more like the dialogue, the conversation, the media coverage you see from these influencers. Fran earlier was talking about some of the problems of social media, about the ability to fact check, about sort of it being more of an open channel to say whatever you want. But, you know, more and more you're seeing even the New York Times cover stories as if they're covering it like an influencer. They're capitalizing on short little sound bites. They're bringing more attention to some little statement that a candidate maybe said, and rather than getting down into the nitty-gritty details. And that's why I think there's so much complaint, at least for me anyway, about how legacy media covers things these days, is that they're
but
doing
Terry,
it more.
But, Terry, don't you think the New York Times is just, you know, surfing the moment? I mean, if you think about it, New York Times has gone big time into digital, into podcasts.
I want my memoir to be surfing the moment.
I am from California. What can I say? I'm the only one who wears flip-flops in Northampton. I'm just telling you. No, I mean, Terry, it's like I think New York Times has gone big time into this in recognition. And, you know, you see audio clips, you see video clips, whether you want to see them or not. You know, sometimes I'm not in a place with, you know, earbuds and, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, it's making noise for everybody around me. But because that's the default.
Yeah.
So I think the New York Times is really embracing this. And when I want to read long form stuff now, I read my favorite magazine, Unsolicited Praise, The Atlantic. I like The New Yorker. You know, The Economist has good stuff, but they have a paywall. You know, I think is good long-form stuff, but it's not so much in The New York Times these days.
I want to ask a question, Terry. I mean, because you were talking about this, and I thought you were going to go there, and you didn't, and I just want to ask you about it. I see a lot of articles. Where they'll say something will have happened, and they'll say, and the internet loses it, and then they'll take like four or five influencers, and they'll do screen grabs from their Instagram or their X profiles and put them up, and it maybe it's a very prominent influencer, maybe it's somebody who's lesser known, and they use that almost as the old fashioned man in the street interview. Woman in the street interview that would take place at the time. They don't, and I see that a lot, which seems to me, is that coverage? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I see that a lot too. And I think it's the legacy media's way of saying, you know, we've got to figure out a way to compete with this thing called TikTok, where these individuals are sometimes drawing in more viewers than we're getting on a daily basis. And the way maybe we can do that is to use them as part of our story. I just wanted to comment on something Fran said. I do think that legacy media types like the New York Times are definitely rising to the moment and doing everything they can possibly think of on digital platforms to appeal to a wider audience. But it's still different because when you think of the New York Times, you can't really put a particular face or a particular voice on it. There isn't one person that really speaks for the New York Times. Thankfully, I think that's a good thing. But what many in, say, the Gen Z generation respond to now is they do respond to, like, that one voice, that one person that really speaks to them. And that's why they continue to gain more and more traction. And I'm not sure how legacy media can really appeal to that, because you're never going to want to turn over your journalistic coverage to one voice.
I think the fastest way to kind of delegitimize the edginess and the immediacy of a new trend is for older people to try to bring it into the mainstream. You know, we could have been having this conversation several years ago about, wow, there's this thing called Facebook and so many people are on it and it seems so important. And, you know, I remember when the Egyptian revolution happened in 2011 and people were saying it was a Facebook revolution and it was so important. Fast forward to the time to now, most young people don't have anything to do with Facebook.
It's true.
It is older people like us who are on it, and that has absolutely killed it for its edginess and its immediacy. So there's always going to be this attempt to keep up with the latest thing, whatever it is. And when the latest thing is happening, people who are older, to be blunt about it, are going to say, can you believe that, you know, now X is happening or Y is happening? And there will be some way where the new thing will emerge to avoid that. And it's just the perpetual cycle of this kind of thing going on. So to bring these people into the Democratic National Convention, yeah, I mean, you know, in a highly curated event and an attempt to reach out to youth voters, voters that were particularly not going to vote for Joe Biden, sure, it might have some marginal effect. But beyond that, I think the largest effect will be it's going to prompt some new thing to pop up that we haven't heard of yet.
So the only thing I would say, I want to go to you, Fran, because I was going to put this in your lap anyway. But we have about 2.5 minutes. But to what Jim was just saying, it seems to me, however, that if anything could go right here, is that, since Jim was saying we want to look at good news, that if anything could go right here, it's that this is a campaign, the Harris-Walz campaign so far has been a campaign that has, by most notices, done an extremely good job when it comes to social media and social media platforms and bringing young people in and bringing enthusiasm in. So doesn't this then make perfect sense?
Absolutely.
And maybe less than marginal and much more than that to bring 200 people in to a convention that maybe they would not have been invited to otherwise and say, all right, folks, go to town.
I don't dispute that at all. I'm just saying this is nothing that's terribly earth-shattering or revolutionary or somehow illuminates the importance of a phenomenon that we didn't already know about. I mean, this is just, you know, the big Democratic Party trying to find a way to reach out to youth voters.
But if it works, isn't that revolutionary?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think to the point you're saying, it's already working, and so great. You know, it's not any big surprise, it seems to me.
Go get them, Fran.
A surprise. I think this is a brilliant move. Yeah. If you think about it, and this
it's
is,
good. I'm not denying it. I'm just saying
I think it's a brilliant move. I think the picosecond that Biden said, I'm not running and Kamala is, within 24 hours, two amazing things happened to me. First of all, Kamala was a boss. She called up 100 people. She got all the delegates on her side. She completely squished any discussion of, well, should we have some town halls and we're not really sure what we want. You know, she was the one. And everybody was for her. And everybody who would have been part of those town halls was for her. And she did that. That's leadership. That's strategic thinking. I was really impressed by that. That's number one. Number two,
1 minute.
The
Go
thing
ahead.
That just blew my mind was that all of the Gen Z and the millennial people stopped being bullied or stopped ignoring Trump. I mean, Trump has just said all of this weird, crazy stuff. He's called people names. He's, you know, he does kindergarten stuff all the time. He does this narcissistic stuff all the time. And somehow the Biden campaign and the rest of us was like, oh, Trump said something mean. Oh, Trump called me cranky, or, you know, Trump did this or that. And there would be insane amounts of press about it. And, you know, they called, I don't know, Vance or somebody called, you know, Democrats like childless cat ladies. And the whole internet went wild. Childless cat ladies for Kamala.
Right.
White dudes for Kamala. Nerds for Kamala, space aliens for Kamala. You know, I mean, everybody just played it out for what it was, which is this sort of hysterical, inconsequential, stupid stuff.
I've got to take a break, but we'll continue on that train. We got a lot of letters too.
And all of my hard work will finally pay.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A lot going on, and we're talking about the Democratic National Convention, and that'll get underway this afternoon, tonight.
And Joe, can I mention something about the convention
absolutely.
Before we move on to another story?
Well, we're just going to go to letters because we have a lot of people writing about this, and we welcome your letters, too. WAMC, panel at WAMC.org. Yes.
So I'm influencers of a different sort, and this kind of goes back to what Terry was talking about and the past of the Democratic Party. And I say this is sort of the past, the present, and the potential future. And I'm just curious to what extent and how will the Kennedy family be involved in the convention? They made a very big show, minus one Kennedy, of endorsing Joe Biden, and they had a major event at the White House, I think on St. Patrick's Day or around St. Patrick's Day. And obviously, you know, an important part of the past of the party, and we have RFK Jr., who is still running, but apparently shopping around for potential cabinet positions with either of the candidates. And at least one of those members of the Kennedy family is somebody who is on that Democratic bench, Joe Kennedy III, who unfortunately primaried Ed Markey in 2020, and he lost. He's now the special envoy to Northern Ireland and has been involved in some ways. So I just wonder, because of the kind of the storied history of this family, but the complications of now and the continued resonance of 1968 and all of that. Will there be any kind of Kennedy involvement? Are there any speakers? Is there anything like that happening? That's a different kind of influencer.
Yeah, I think we'll see some surprises at the, you know, I mean, I was listening yesterday. I was in the car, so we were listening to NPR, and they were asking the guy, one of the guys who was the organizer, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And he's like, we want there to be some surprises. So no, we're not going to tell you everything that's going to happen. I think you'll see maybe Taylor Swift, maybe Beyonce. Maybe you'll see a Kennedy. I just think, getting back to the social influencers for one moment, it's all about the youth vote. It's all about making sure that the youth come out and vote, because they were going to stay home, and we can't afford for them to stay home. So this is a way to talk to them.
We have many letters, and I want to get to as many as we can. Our panelists, is there anyone who cannot stay to 11 o'clock this morning?
Oh, I can stay.
I can stay.
All right.
I'm here.
All right. I haven't heard from Terry, but if that's a problem, let me know. Otherwise,
I'm here.
Okay, sounds good. Then we'll go through the letters here and get to a lot of them that'll make people happy, or you know, happier maybe. I don't know. Tricia says, "I think it's not a great idea that so many people make their decisions about important things based on some random quote popular person on some social media platform who may or may not have truth and objectivity on their agenda. After all, these quote-unquote influencers are doing this for views, followers, and yes, money. the truth, quote unquote, may not be their main motivation. Anything you would like to say about that, Fran?
I agree with that, by the way. I think that we all listen to sources, and we don't always vet what's going on. My brother and I are diametrically opposed politically, and we had a huge argument several elections ago. And what really struck me is that there's a bunch of sources that my brother reads that he considers credible, and he does not consider my sources credible. And there's a bunch of sources I read that I consider credible, and I don't consider his sources credible. And now you add social media into that. And indeed, who becomes an influencer has something to do with the content of what they do, but it has a lot to do with how they do it. It has a lot to do with algorithmic things. So if you make the things that you put on social media appeal to people so they spend a little bit of time looking at them, then you are more likely to see those things algorithmically. And things like that as time goes on. And so in some sense, there's a whole machine that feeds these things that has very little to do with the veracity of the content. And so I agree with the letter writers. I think this is also true to some extent with a little less so, but to some extent with the New York Times and MSNBC and Fox News and all of it. I think we are losing a notion of what's truthful. In fact, even this sort of, Grindr, the RNC being the Super Bowl of Grindr comment, I looked it up on Snopes, which is a fact-checking website, to see, is this a real thing, or did someone just make it up or think it sounded good? And it turned out that they could not find evidence that this was actually said by, an executive at Grindr. So you have to really follow these things up. But I'll say one more thing, because I don't want to dominate, but I'm writing a book on public interest technology, and I was looking up how many people got their information about COVID during the pandemic on social media. And it turns out that a huge majority of Americans got information about what was legitimate science and not on social media. And most of them didn't bother to vet it, because that's not really how we use social media for the most part. But so I definitely agree with the letter writer, but it's a much bigger problem than these influencers. You know, they're just surfing the moment.
I know Terry wanted in, then we'll go to Jim.
Yeah, just one thing that the letter writer said. I do think it's important to point out that you can just go through the list. ABC, NBC, TBS, CNN, Fox News, all of these media companies do it for the money. They all do it for profit. Yes, influencers are making a profit too, but I think it's important to clarify that all of these largely followed media outlets rely heavily on a profit. And that profit is directly connected oftentimes to how they cover the news because of who the advertisers are, the audience they're appealing to in terms of who those advertisers can attract. It's all connected. I don't think this day and time there is really that much difference in how a legacy media outlet and a largely followed influencer go about attracting their audience and go about making a profit through advertising. It's a very similar model. It's just that one is done basically single-handedly through one spokesperson. The other is a giant conglomerate of a corporation, with the exception of a few nonprofit media outlets out there that are still managing to hang on. I just wanted to make that distinction.
Sure. Or Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to make a similar point to the one that Terry made, but I would also just add that I think we ought not to get too nostalgic about the halcyon days when people were focused on three networks. To the letter writer's point about, what is driving the influencers, well, those networks over, the life of TV were looking for viewers, ratings, and to make money. Now, to what extent was the news skewed along those lines, one can, dig into various stories and figure that out. But the, these were these were and are, as Terry was saying, these are money-making enterprises. That's their reason for being. That's why they do what they do. So, for print media and others, I mean, they stay in business because they make money, and when they stop making money, they go out of business. So I don't think we should get overly nostalgic.
We go to Eileen, who says the Democrats have a stellar lineup of speakers available. The Democratic Party is in a position to let them shine. The Republicans could not offer anything close to this, and they are so far gone, they could not even invite their former president, George Bush. Let the Dems show off their amazing lineup. I think Bill Clinton can be forgiven if he does not speak with the power he had as a younger campaigning candidate. And it would be remiss to not include Secretary Clinton. She was the guinea pig as the person running against Donald Trump. Never before had anyone faced a candidate of her opponent's ilk. Then we go to this from Stella. Comment to discussion. It is important to have the support of past presidents and let them speak. However, personally, listening to the 20-something generation, it is just as important for the Democratic, younger Democratic politicians to speak at the convention. With Harris on the ballot, a new energy and excitement to go and vote has been revived. Then Jill checks in and says, sure, cater to the younger voters, but remember, you still have us old voters who want to see our political heroes. More than just progressives and moderates have to be united. So do the generations. Don't kick the old folk to the curb in order to bring up those youngins. Then we go to Amy, who says Stacey Abrams has her own podcast now called Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams. It is produced by Crooked Media. She just did an episode of Pod Save America. She's on the ground in Georgia. Still, but I agree, they could amplify her more, but she is crushing it. Then we go to Steve.
Yay! Thank you.
Since conventions no longer nominate, primetime needs to be filled. Having Bill speak is fine as long as he doesn't go all 1988 on us.
And what's that mean?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. It doesn't go for too long. Bring out the saxophone. Go to town. Adam Navarro, a Republican, is one of the hosts of the convention. I wish that Adam Kinzinger, who said he was voting for Harris, would be on the stage. I know he is working with CNN in their coverage. Then we go to Mona says, here's a question. What education do these influencers have? Well, does that matter?
No, because it's the reach they have.
Yeah, I mean, what education do people on pundits on the news have? I listen to these people. They have opinions. They maybe talk to people. Do they have a degree in political science? Have they worked in the government? Do they know anything? I mean, it's hard to say about influences on social media, but it's also hard to say about people on TV.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll get to more letters. We'll include yours, panel@wamc.org. Last call. We're going up to 11 o'clock with our panel. Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, Terry Gibson, Fran Berman, and you. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I'm Joe Donahue. I have to ask this question. What's a lot of money now? You know, you had like the $25,000 question, or you say, here's the $100,000 question, or you say, here's the $1 million question. So what is a large sum, like what makes it seem like it's a really important, valuable question?
Well, I would say at least a million, maybe 10.
Okay. All right. And you said billion, Fran? Is that right? Billion?
Yep.
Okay. So with here is the $1 billion question from another friend who says, with all the excitement and the horrific voices from the right, why isn't there more of a lead for the Democrats? Terry Gibson.
Well, how much money is on the line again?
$1 billion.
Okay. All right. Just want to
make
sure
it worth your while.
Is appropriate,
yeah,
to the prize. Okay. So, wow. Well, you know, I think we are still watching the entire landscape slowly shift from what was Biden-Trump to Harris-Trump. And that does take some time. There are still a lot of voters out there that know Harris. They know who she is, but they don't really know anything about her. And it takes those group of people a little more time to follow the news, decide what they think, begin to respond to pollsters. It takes time for the pollsters to find these people to get their opinion. And the numbers have shifted. While the lead is still not gigantic, it's not significant, it still could go either way. We have to recognize that these numbers have shifted in ways that we really haven't seen in modern times. It's just dramatic. It's amazing. It's incredible. It's exciting. And I think if the Democrats can continue doing what they're doing in a very strategic way of communicating to all these people, you're going to see those numbers continue to increase. But I think it's also important to remember that no matter how well Harris does, no matter how well their campaign does, this is still going to be an extremely close election. Donald Trump is going to still garner a significant amount of voters, and we have to really all get out there and do what we can to make sure she gets elected. And I hope that they have a extensive team of lawyers on standby, because there's going to be a lot of court suits coming no matter which way this goes.
Seems to already be happening. Mm-hmm. Jim?
I think part of the answer to this is, and by the way, I don't know if I don't want the $1 billion. I'd like mine denominated in Mallow Cup coupons.
Yes, okay.
But
we'll get you that drink.
Yeah. Yes. part of it is just the country is so polarized that irrespective of who the two candidates are, it's always going to be close. And in many ways, the Democrats are lucky that the Republicans have decided to, despite everything, stick with Trump. Because if you go back and look at the polling numbers of Haley head-to-head against Biden, polling numbers a few months ago, she would handily beat Biden. And she would definitely poll, even right now, much higher than Trump. So as close as it is, there's, as Terry was saying, there's a lot that people still have to learn about Kamala Harris. And but even if it were considered, like she's going to win going away, the numbers are still going to be relatively close, because that's just the structure of our heavily polarized politics of our time.
Yeah, it'll probably be 48-52, something to that effect.
That would be considered a landslide.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. Then it's still early. I mean, She's only been the nominee for, a month? Actually, the actual nominee for a lot less than that. But it's only been about a month. And it is early. And the polls, look, we know the polls are just guideposts. Because in 2016, Hillary was winning all the polls, and then she lost the election. So there's just so much faith that you can put in polling. And I'm sure if they polled Republicans and said, are you going to vote for Trump versus Kamala? Who are you going to vote for? There'll be plenty of Republicans who will say Trump, but will go to the polls and either not vote or vote for Harris, because there are so many Republicans who are just so disgusted. And they have a home now. I mean, there's Liz Cheney, there's Adam Kinzinger. There's other folks. There's the mayor of Mesa, Arizona, who came out and endorsed Harris. I think you're going to see more of that, especially as Trump and Vance sound more and more unhinged. I mean, really. Like, I watched a little bit of Trump, and he's just really unhinged.
In Wilkes-Barre, in Pennsylvania?
Yeah. He's really unhinged. And the whole thing about the Medal of Freedom and Miriam Adelson, last night on MSNBC, they had like four recipients of the Medal of Honor, and they were one of the recipients. He was a vet. He was a veteran. I mean, that's who this goes to. Yeah. And of course, Trump is like, well, she's alive and all these other people are dead. So what's the use of giving them an award?
When you're the Republican candidate, and you're being denounced by the head of the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
You know there's something wrong.
Something has turned upside down.
Right. So here's a question that I was with a buddy this weekend, and we were duking this out, not physically, of course. just mentally,
I'd like to see that.
Vigorously. Yeah, I don't. Obviously, I don't fight. but who are? 2 months ago, we were talking about undecideds. I don't know, Libby. You're the political expert. Are there undecideds anymore? I mean, how many undecideds are there now?
I think that there are still a swath of voters who haven't made up their mind. It might not be 30%. Because that's what it's always been. It's been 30-30-30. And
so
then
you're saying that there is a group of voters that is large enough to make a difference in this election that have yet to come to terms with whether they're going to vote for Kamala Harris or Donald Trump?
I don't know if it's a big enough group at this point to make a difference in the election, per se, because I'm not a pollster and I'm not reading that. But I still do think that there are people who are undecided. And based on what state they're in, that's where it can make the difference, because it all will once again come down to the swing states.
Right. A Georgia undecided is different than a New York undecided.
Right. And the Electoral College.
But I think the undecideds come in two different types. Aside from, the New York Times always being able to find a few undecided voters in a diner in Erie, Pennsylvania, I think the undecideds are those who haven't decided who they're going to vote on. I think that's really a very small number. I think the bigger undecided categories are they're deciding, are they going to vote?
Well, that's what
will they turn out?
And that's where our conversation was, right?
Yeah.
Are they going to vote at all? And the people who were going to vote, let's say, would be in a position to vote for Biden and had issues and just said, I'm going to sit this one out.
Right.
And may not have that issue.
Yeah, my question for Libby is 30%, I have no data, Libby, and you probably do, but 30% sounds like a lot.
It used to be.
When I look at the campaigns, it's Trump doesn't seem to be looking to expand his base. I mean, okay, maybe he's being a little softer on stuff that the right-wing racist and immigrant, anti-immigrant folks are really unhappy about, but he doesn't really look to be broadening his base. The Kamala Wolf campaign, or Kamala Tim campaign, I should say, looks like they're trying to broaden at least to kind of the maximum size of the traditional Democratic base, because that may have shrunk a bit during the Biden campaign and beyond if they can.
Well, it's like this.
I don't see anybody kind of really hitting that middle ground for people. I can't even imagine don't have an opinion about this.
1 minute warning.
Okay. It used to be like 35, and then 30 undecided. I think that 30 of undecided is a lot smaller now, but I still do think that there are some of those people out there, and they may stay home altogether and not vote, because there are some Republicans who just can't bring themselves to vote on the Democratic line. And that's their option. And there are Democrats who can't bring themselves to vote on the Republican line either. So I think you'll see some people staying home. But I think that undecided vote is smaller, but it really has to do with what state it's in at this point.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to everyone. Thanks for staying on late, going into extra innings. I appreciate it. Very nice to have you. We'll continue discussing the convention, of course, throughout the week, and be offering NPR coverage as well as WAMC newsroom coverage throughout this week and beyond as we work our way to Election Day. My thanks to all of you. You're all wonderful. I appreciate you being here. We'll be back right after this.